welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host. Our guest, new to the show, Peter Carter, co-author with Cardinal Robert Sarah himself of The Song of the Lamb, Sacred Music, and the Heavenly Liturgy, published by our great friends over at Ignatius Press and available naturally through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Great to meet you. And, of course, people would have seen you on with Women of Grace with Jeanette Knowles. Of course, I'm with the one and only Father Mitch there. So we appreciate you taking the time, and we appreciate you coming by Bookmark to talk about this book. Now, how many books have you written?
This is my first one.
This is your first one. Now, in the beginning here, you talk about how you got involved with Cardinal Sarah, and what kind of book is it? Is it an interview book? Is it on his life? What is it?
Exactly. It is an interview book,
right. And...
He has written several interview books before, and so that was kind of one of the things that gave me a bit of the courage that he might be open to this idea when I approached him several years ago, is that he's done interview books before, and in a certain sense, it's a little less work.
So was this in person, or was this via email, or letters, or what?
It was both,
okay.
Yeah. A lot of it was in person, but for a lot of the kind of in-depth answers, especially with him citing documents and Ratzinger and all these things, those were easier to do with written responses, and so I integrated them into the current book to kind of make it seamless.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes these off-the-cuff remarks for
That was the thing. That
I was hierarchical members of the church aren't always the most productive, right?
Well, even with I was reading the transcripts of our conversations, and I would have an outline of where I would want to go, but also you want it to be freeform and natural.
Dynamic in responding.
And in reading the transcripts, it was good content, but it was kind of all over the place in terms of if that was a book, it just wouldn't make sense in terms of that flow. But if you were watching it, it would.
Right.
So, but I wanted to make sure that the book was kind of more tightly organized with the themes.
Now, you say in the preface, in January 2023, I approached him and collaborating on the books. You say, we made an effort to avoid critiques and current debates over the use of particular liturgical books. Why?
I think, a couple reasons, but one primarily was that we wanted to speak to the timeless tradition of sacred music and the church's teaching on sacred music, which hasn't changed despite the various publications of the Roman Missal, right? So the legislation on sacred music and the principles haven't changed from one liturgy to another. They remain constant, and so that's kind of what we wanted to highlight more. And
the continuity
that's supposed to be there of the sacred music, and then again, not that those other discussions about say the traditional Latin Mass and reform and the reform and all those things, not that those are unimportant discussions.
But you want to get caught up in that discussion.
Exactly, that's not what this purpose.
And people say,
is
"Well, you're just pushing Latin Mass stuff here, so I'm not going to read this."
Right, and that's just completely not. We wanted to sidestep that whole thing so we could still make progress.
Like you said, the contents of this book are a compilation of written responses to interview questions I submitted, as well as in-person interviews I had with His Eminence in June of 2023 and January 2024. Who's Charlie Deist or Deist?
Deist.
Deist. Who's he?
He is a man in California who helped me with transcribing everything, and so he was very helpful in putting
the format. So when Cardinal Sarah wrote back, did he write back in English, or did he write back in...
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he had an Italian text for some of the written responses, but we spoke in English, and so English was the primary text.
Now, the foreword's by Malcolm Cardinal Ranjith, Archbishop of Colombo, Sri Lanka. Why was he chosen to do the foreword? Did Cardinal Sarah choose him, or who chose him?
Yeah, he did, and he worked with Cardinal Sarah in the Vatican and in the Congregation of Divine Worship, and so they knew each other well. I have never met Cardinal Ranjith yet, but I was very, very happy to kind of have his contribution to this book, and he's
a very
knowledgeable scholar.
What did you think overall of his thoughts about the book?
I was just glad he appreciated it, and he kind
of seemed like he did. Right.
He goes kind of through the structure of the book and presents it kind of encapsulated.
Well, he starts off with the idea that since the Eucharistic liturgy is essentially an Actio Dei, which draws us into Christ through the Holy Spirit, its basic structure is nothing something within, it's not something within our power to change, nor can it be held hostage by the latest trends. And that's Pope Benedict the 16th mm-hmm. in his statement. But why is it a sense that people don't think that, or certain people in the church don't think that? It seems like it's something they can kind of play around with, or that it's always evolving.
Yeah, I mean, part of the nature of the liturgy is that it is the work of Christ. You know, we say the origin of the word, the Greek word of liturgy is the work of the people. Mm-hmm. But as Cardinal Sarah speaks to in the first part of that book of what Christian liturgy is, mm-hmm. is it's not just the work of, say, the people of God and the church. It's the work of the Trinity, mm-hmm. the Opus Trinitatis. It's the work of the Son offering himself to the Father. And so when we are worshiping God in the Mass, that's only possible because Christ is worshiping the Father, and through his incarnation and through the institution of the sacraments, he invites us to participate in his work.
Right?
That, you know, as the priest says, you know, pray, my brethren, that your sacrifice and yours may be offered to the Lord.
Right, so, absolutely.
Exactly. So it's uniting our sacrifice.
Well, that's
Christ.
Where you talk a lot, and he talks a lot about the difference between understanding what do we mean by active participation.
Yeah.
Right. Activity versus active participation. There is a difference, right? And you
there
talk
is.
About it in the book.
And you know, in kind of also preferring in some ways the term actual participation,
which.
You know, active, especially in English, can have the connotation that we need to be moving.
It needs to be physical.
Right. It needs to be busy. And it's, you know, kind of generally more on the surface level, because you don't generally think of, say, listening as something active, right?
Or contemplation being active.
Right, exactly. But understood properly, mm-hmm. yes, that's what participation can mean in the liturgy. It can mean all of the above. Mm-hmm. In Latin, it's actuo, so participatio. So it's actual participation of the whole person. Mm-hmm. And so it is.
And what do we mean by the whole person?
So body and soul, mind mm-hmm. and spirit, right?
Okay.
It's not just that about, you know, standing, sitting,
physical
kneeling,
and
you know,
standards,
singing. All of those
replies.
Things are good and important, right? They're not unimportant, but they're not the whole story, right? And so we are participating just as much when we're hearing the scriptures proclaimed, when we're, say, listening to the homily, also when the choir sings some of, say, the chants of the church, say, if they're singing the introit, and that's not a that particular chant is not usually a congregational song.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that the congregation's not participating, though. Just as they're participating by listening to the readings, they can mm-hmm. participate by listening to the choir mm-hmm. or cantor sing at certain points. And then at other parts of the Mass, they are also, the whole congregation is invited to sing as well, like mm-hmm. the Sanctus, Agnus Dei.
He writes in the beginning here, the constant praise of God in heaven is the key to understanding salvation history. It's part of God's action to render sacred all the creation, freed from sin and transformed from its fallen state, with the emergence of the new people of God and the new Jerusalem. He goes on to say in this that our task is to recognize the immensity of what is already happening in the presence of God, be respectful of what we have received faithfully, adhere to this Actio Dei of heavenly and sanctifying praise, and make our lives compatible with these mysteries.
Yeah.
Now let's adjust the Mass to make me feel better about what's going on, right?
Exactly. It's not about us. It's about Christ and his sacrifice. And even as Cardinal Sarah talks about enculturation in this book and in other places, he said it's not about some bringing our culture to have some cultural representation in the liturgy, because mm-hmm. that would make it about us, right? Enculturation in the Christian sense means imbuing the culture
right,
with
you have
Christ.
A whole discussion about that proper enculturation. What do we mean by that? And certainly,
right.
It's very interesting because of Cardinal Sarah's own situation
exactly,
with the French missionaries and how was that handled.
Right.
And he makes that point of the separation between what they did in their village celebrations and what was allowed at the Mass.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, and there was kind of a clear demarcation of what is sacred and what is, you know, secular outside of the church.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Now, he talks about the central theme of the book. The book consists of 14 chapters that deal with a series of pertinent questions on liturgy as a whole, its sublimity and importance for the life of the church, and the threats and challenges it faces with the passage of time. What are these threats, do you think?
I think, I mean, one of the things with sacred music is the kind of constant threat of, or the need, rather, of education and formation. And if we don't communicate our tradition, whether that's sacred music, but any form of, you know, if we don't impart what's important to us about the faith, right, then the next generation will be deprived of that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's like what John Paul II was just so beautifully teaching about the church's, you know, sexual ethics and sexual teaching theology of the body, and helped to communicate that to generations, right? And so that's just one example, but that's one of the things that kind of constantly needs to be reinforced, that especially in regards to sacred music has been neglected for generations. And
was that an oversight or an undersight?
Well, I think there's many, many different reasons. I mean, one of them is even just cultural and economic. Mm. You know, in the United States, I mean, there's kind of many books on this of, like, you know, why Catholics can't sing is one.
Right. I remember that book, right.
But, you know, and just that of Irish Catholicism being, you know, the backbone in many parts of American Catholicism, and that, you know, generally the Irish Catholicism was poor and didn't have, the schools in the way that the establishment Anglican churches did and Episcopal churches in the U.S. So usually, say, in developing institutions that have permanence and established traditions, like, say, choral foundations in the Anglican tradition in England, you know, it takes some degree of establishment and permanence in order to develop a full tradition, right?
Is it possible in some of those, the Anglican tradition, let's say, that, form over function in some of these things where they sing beautiful hymns, but I'm not sure how many people who are singing them actually believe them?
Yeah, no, that's a great observation of the reality today, and a lot of the Anglican Church, Episcopal Church, is, you know, they do have a great focus on aesthetic education you know, a lot of education, a lot of these things, but it's not really kind of the beliefs are a little bit more, say, fluid all the time with what's
acceptable and what's not. There's a proper way of doing things. It doesn't mean that what's driving behind it. Now he says, along with the subject of sacred music in general, this book considers the transformative value of Gregorian chant and congregational singing, the value of silence and contemplation, we mentioned, especially in relation to the correct understanding of actual participation in contrast to active participation, which we talked a little bit about, and the value of the Latin language, and the Second Vatican Council's insistence on Latin as the proper liturgical language, and he even says, which has been largely ignored, and dealing instead with issues of enculturation, the importance of the role of priests and bishops for liturgical renewal, the importance of beauty. We hear that a lot. I know Father Dubé wrote a beautiful book about beauty. Why are these things so important? Why do we feel that they've been left on the side?
Well, the if Catholicism is the fullness of truth, but also of goodness and beauty, if it reflects all the attributes of God, you know, it kind of needs to be constantly communicated in it, it's all its essence. And so, you know, sometimes one aspect can be more emphasized than another, you know, and I talk with some friends and fellow, you know, Catholic artists and things and say, you know, talk about, you know, there has been a great kind of Catholic intellectual revival and great resources in the past decades of, say, Catholic apologetics and, you know, there's wonderful things happening in certain spheres, but there's still a great need to kind of recover beauty in the Catholic, you know, imagination and what that looks like. What does culture look like, and how do we understand that from a Catholic perspective? Right. And what does it look like to imbue the culture? Like, if the culture of our parishes is poor, how can we expect the culture outside of our parishes to be rich, right?
But then you look at St. Pat's or places like that. Now, those people who built that were poor, many of them. I mean, there might have been a couple of very wealthy donors, but the vast majority of the people were going there, and those people who built those beautiful churches were poor people.
Right, and I just mean culturally impoverished.
I see what you mean.
Not in regards to money, but if people were stuck on TikTok or something. Yeah, if our parishes and the liturgies are banal, right, and it's just kind of like, you know, we might as well have Mass in a warehouse, right?
There's not this sense of you're entering another world in a sense of sacred place.
That this is
that
not
where life is different than it is on the outside.
And that's not going to capture the hearts and minds of the faithful coming to worship God, right? It's all these things need to lend themselves to express our faith, to express our praise, and that's what I mean when our parishes are, you know, real families and real, united in that the masses are beautiful, the families are strong, right? Then the culture surrounding the parishes can be really strong. So I think that's how we begin to help shape culture.
Now, one of the things I think this is Cardinal Sarah who said, the Mass is not merely an endeavor by the people of God, rather it is the work of the Most Holy Trinity enacted for the people of God, the Church.
Yes.
Right. Because sometimes I think with the people of God, we can end up with the people of God versus, the Church being, something that's more focused on God, and the people of God kind of sounds like a democratic way of thinking.
Right.
The sense of the faithful, if we all decide something's true now,
right,
then it's okay.
Right. Yeah.
Versus the mystical body, so to speak.
Exactly. And it's if we make it about the people of God primarily, then it's also just making it about us.
Right.
And it's removing this Christological focus. And it's not, again, that we are unimportant and that our role is unimportant, but it only has its value and importance because it's united with Christ's sacrifice.
Right, and it's not supposed to be, I didn't get anything out of it. The question is, what do you put into it?
What do you offer Christ?
He says, there is a real danger in reducing the liturgy to a mere feel-good experience as if the Church were offering a spiritual palliative on Sunday mornings.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And it's like, it kind of like all the, self-help articles of, life hacks of what are your top three things you get out of this, top three takeaways. And, that's not how we're supposed to approach Mass, because it's the same idea. Like, that's not how you approach a relationship with a person,
Right.
What are your top three takeaways with your wife this morning,
That's right. Give me the top five things I learned by tomorrow, and just show me the boxes I need to check, right?
Exactly, it's a relationship. It's more human, more natural,
right.
And that's God's calling us all to relationship with Him.
Well, it's interesting too, because he basically talks about the materialistic and secularist orientation of life, especially in what he calls the formerly Christian North. He talks about secular society has seeped into the Church herself. When the transcendent divine nature of the liturgy is no longer understood or appreciated, it becomes easy to settle for mediocrity. And the Cardinal laments resistance and even opposition to efforts to promote liturgical beauty, even describing it as a sad situation and talking about the Western Hemisphere and the death of God.
Yeah.
I thought this was an interesting, Church has to make tangible expression of love, mercy, and a call to return to its great mission. But then, the Lord says, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. I never thought of it in relation to like where we are now.
Yeah.
That there's lots of people out there, I think, who are searching. And in some cases, we're not willing to stand up for the truth and realizing the truth will attract. Because it seems to be, we're seeing a lot of the, if you want to attract younger people today, you have to order for them something different. Different isn't guitars and pizza. They get that
right.
at home.
Yeah.
But sacred music.
When that's fine,
and
just
the
do
liturgy,
that after Mass.
Right.
You know?
We're Catholics. We don't live in a commune. We live in a society, and we're supposed to improve the society. And that's why we're supposed to get something out of Mass and go into the world, not rush up on the altar.
Right.
And say, what's my job? Because I know one of the ones in here, there was a mention about the idea of somebody being annoyed because, somebody was like taking their job. A layperson was normally doing this, and you see that and you say, yeah, but that's not your job.
Right, that's not what participation
is. You're filling in, and you shouldn't feel like you as a Catholic are being diminished because there happens to be a priest or somebody or a deacon who has to do this. In the very beginning, you talk about, you ask him the question, you said, Your Eminence, when did your appreciation, passion for sacred music first emerge? What did he say?
Well, he grew up in the musical culture in his village in Africa, in Urus. Also the faith was imbued both with his parents, with
his
the
father,
French
especially, right? He mentions,
yeah.
Right? His father.
Yeah.
He got a lot of it from his father. At least that's what I, mm-hmm. I gleaned from the book.
And seeing the priest in prayer, I mean, that's also that leading by example, and it's who we are when the eyes are not on us, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, sometimes right. we, you know, are seen when we don't think the eyes are on us, but like the priest in prayer on his own time, right? In the church, and that's what really inspired Cardinal Serra, is the faith he saw in the missionaries,
right.
Who were giving their lives.
French missionaries
right. in Guinea, giving their lives to communicate this faith. And okay, this is important, right? So,
well, you asked him, what were the principles or criteria that the church gives for music to be considered appropriate for liturgical celebrations? That's where you get into, well, you know, shouldn't it be? It used to be. It seemed to me that you had to be at least have scripture or something attached to the music, and then suddenly songs were just coming in that seemed to have no attachment or maybe a peripheral attachment.
Yeah, so there is kind of a distinction. There's church teaching on sacred music, and then there's church disciplines. And so the teaching of speaking specifically about sacred music, mm-hmm. A big part of that is the writings of St. Pius X on his document
right,
on sacred
talk about
music.
Him,
and
right.
he gives the principles right. of, you know,
those are
the
early 1900s, 1903, somewhere around
1903,
there.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
Giving the three main principles right. of sacredness, you know, beauty and integrity of art and universality as the criteria for what constitutes sacred music. And then through that, that's kind of how we can decipher mm-hmm. of what music is appropriate, right. even in various styles.
You talk about the allure of popular music, and you said, for instance, in my home state of New Jersey, where music is widely appreciated, the music sung and performed in churches often mirrors Broadway or Disney tunes, albeit with religious lyrics.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the common experience of,
right.
you know, a lot of suburban parishes mm-hmm. in the U.S., not just New Jersey, but New Jersey especially, I am so grateful that there is kind of a wide appreciation for music. I mean, a lot of the schools in New Jersey, a lot of people on Broadway mm-hmm. grew up in Jersey, right?
Yeah, sure,
and were on
sure,
shows.
Of course,
and
right,
so
right.
there is a lot of love for music.
Well, again, it's great music.
Yeah.
It's great music.
Yeah.
But the question is it appropriate in a sacred
yeah.
situation, right?
Well, and I've fortunately, you know, experienced a lot of openness to, you know, in living in New Jersey to the music that I offer and bring and try to form in people. And, you know, there's a lot of love for music, and it's not just, say, hating on the music I don't like, you know, or think is not appropriate for
Mass. Now, it's a discussion here about, is there a difference between pop music, which targets mass society, and folk music, which is a traditional expression of a cohesive community? What's the distinction there?
I think it could be said that pop music is more commercialized, you know, mm-hmm. and formulaic, usually consumer-focused for a specific product, and whereas folk music, it generally just emerges more naturally, organically, from, you know, learning an instrument and not kind of having this particular consumer focus.
Right.
Yeah.
And this place, I was thinking earlier discussion, it's not the faithful to have a right, that's what I was referring to sing that responsorial psalm
yeah.
that is then unjustly taken away from them when the choir sings it instead.
Yeah, and especially in the Novus Ordo Mass, there's lots of options
right.
for various parts of the Mass. And so sometimes when one option is chosen that's different than what some of the faithful are used mm. to, you know, they get upset.
Right.
And I think our attitude just needs to be one of humility. Like, the church right. allows different options, different forms, and, you know, it's okay that it's not going to be always what we're used to, mm-hmm. and we just need to be humble and open to that, rather than just saying, I don't like that, you know, I want to change back, you know.
Right, no, that's true.
It's not about you, you know.
What does he mean by the dictatorship of noise?
Oh, I love that phrase.
Right.
Because yeah, Cardinal Sarah wrote the book, The Power of Silence, mm-hmm. Against the Dictatorship of Noise. And it's such a profound meditation on the noise of the modern world and how it kind of removes an aspect of our humanity that is kind of a prerequisite for having a relationship with God, mm-hmm. right? If we are not kind of able to find silence in ourselves, then we won't be able to hear the voice of God, because mm-hmm. that is the, you know, the still small voice of calm, and that voice of silence is God's voice. And so the dictatorship of noise, I think, is the constant inundation of distraction of, you know, especially cell phones and social media and kind of this constant TikTok, all these things, distraction to fragment our focus. And even ultimately, if over a period of time, that kind of fragments who we are. We don't really even can have a sense of self and develop a sense of self if we don't have, you know,
well, you even have sometimes in the Mass where, you know, a lot of people like to, they go to receive communion and they go back and they kneel back and they pray and they're mm-hmm. view. And then you get somebody writing about, well, you're not supposed to do that. It's all part of the community. You're supposed to come back and sing, you know, along with it. And it's like,
yeah,
what are you talking about?
Well, there's lots
Why
of options.
Bother you?
Yeah, there's lots of there's lots of options that the church allows, and you know, you don't, if it's in one of those options, you don't need to make everybody do the one that you like or you prefer and, you know, ruin it for the rest of
right.
us.
Well, a famous Monsignor from New York once said, scratch a liberal, you get a fascist. Well, thank you very much, Peter
thank
Carter.
You.
Thank you for dropping by the show and talking with us about this book that you co-authored with Cardinal Robert Sarah of the Song of the Lamb. And it's Sacred Music and the Heavenly Liturgy, again, available through the EWTN Religious Catalog. We barely scratched the surface. There's a lot in this book, so check it out. I'm Doug Keck. Check us out next time right here on Bookmark. We'll see you then.